Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all for our last oral argument in this February sitting. And we have with us a group of students from Bigfoot High School. Could they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Some of you were here at the very end of the last oral argument, and I believe some or all of you had an opportunity to spend some time with the other school group and Justice Gableman right after the second argument. And if you didn't, I'm told Justice Gableman will discuss the procedures and processes of the court with you after this argument. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the students come, they're given materials about the case that we are about to hear, and they engage in some activities related to the case in their school. They come, they listen to oral argument, and they meet with a justice who's been assigned for the day to meet with the students. The meeting is about the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not about the substantive issue of the case. Everyone is invited to attend that session. It's not limited to the students. Is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, would you raise your hand? All right. Let me introduce the court then to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Wilkinson. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call the case 11AP1049D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Sharon A. Week. Arguing on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Jonathan E. Hendricks. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, as the Chief Justice stated, my name is Jonathan Hendricks. I'm an assistant litigation counsel with the Office of Lawyer Regulation. I'm here on the matter of OLR versus Rick. And just briefly, this is a case about a prosecutor's duty to disclose exculpatory information and evidence to defense, as well as following Wisconsin's criminal discovery statutes. OLR's complaint has one count with two legal theories in it: a violation of SCR 20:3.8 sub F sub 1 concerning a prosecutor's duty to disclose, and SCR 20:8.4 sub F involving attorneys' responsibility to follow statutes regulating the conduct of lawyers, in this case, the criminal discovery statutes. I just want to take a minute or two to go through the case's facts, because I think this is a case that may depend a bit on some subtleties in the facts. There's an underlying criminal case involving a man named Tyrone Smith.
Counsel? That's over with, right?
Right.
Criminal case.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Would you speak up a bit?
Oh, sure.
Is this okay?
Wait just a minute.
Sorry.
You could do better by, one, raising the podium, and there's
on the
button
left
somewhere.
Side, I think it is.
It looks like it should be a button.
Yeah, maybe closer.
Inside?
To
it. All right.
Oh.
Okay.
Imagine. And then speak into the microphone.
All right, is this volume better?
Much okay. Better.
All right,
thank
sorry.
You.
The underlying criminal case involves a man named Tyrone Smith. There was a traffic stop in Racine County. Mr. Smith was driving a car. In the passenger seat was a man named Isaiah Simpson. Police found drugs in the car. Mr. Smith was charged with possession of those drugs. At the same time, he was on extended supervision, probation, and the state began proceedings to revoke that status and return Mr. Smith to prison. Mr. Simpson, the passenger, went to Mr. Smith's probation officer, claimed responsibility for the drugs, signed a written statement, and Smith eventually won his revocation proceeding. Mr. Simpson also went to the district attorney's office, and at that time, in early November of 2008, the DA office had assigned the respondent, Sharon Rick, to prosecute Smith for this drug charge. Smith had an attorney. His name is Mark Lukoff. Lukoff had filed a formal discovery request requesting exculpatory evidence, among other things. And Simpson went to the district attorney's office early November. He met with the district attorney himself. He confessed to the district attorney, saying that the drugs were his, not Tyrone Smith's. The district attorney wrote down Simpson's contact information, a brief notation that he said that the drugs were his, and then handed that note to the respondent, also orally told her of the meeting the same morning that it occurred. The respondent sent a memo out to the sheriff's department to investigate, asking them to investigate Simpson's statement. They were unable to do so. The respondent did not notify Smith's attorney that this confession, this meeting had taken place at that time. I said that was in early November of 2008. The trial was set for late March of 2009. When Mr. Lukoff, Smith's attorney, was preparing for trial, he met with Mr. Simpson a few days beforehand. He met with him on a Thursday before the trial was set for the next Tuesday. And at that meeting, Mr. Lukoff learned for the first time that Simpson had had this meeting with the district attorney and that he had told the district attorney that he...
Can I just stop you for a minute
sure.
to simplify this
yes.
in my mind? The assistant district attorney had information about this other person confessing when?
We don't know the exact date that the meeting took place and when the district attorney told her. We know it was at least by the date that she asked the sheriff's department to investigate.
What date was that?
November 7th, 2008.
But didn't she have information before that? Because I thought that the whole point here of the defense was, or at least a major point of the defense was, that the defendant had this information because he had gotten it from another source. Isn't that right?
No, I don't believe that's true.
Oh, okay.
Because the information that OLR is concerned with is the Simpson's confession to the district attorney.
All right. You're not concerned that before that there was information in the DA's office about this, but that and that the defendant had it. You're concerned about the 4 days.
I'm sorry, about the what?
You're concerned about the meeting with the DA. That's your only concern.
Correct.
Okay.
So as I was saying, Mr. Lukoff met with Simpson, this passenger. Simpson told him about this meeting in March, a few days before the trial. Smith's attorney contacted the respondent, asked for information about this meeting, asked if there were any recordings of it. Other information. The following day, Friday, the respondent faxed a copy of the note documenting the information that the district attorney had prepared to the defendant's counsel. The following Monday, Mr. Smith's attorney filed a motion for a special prosecutor, named the district attorney as a potential witness. He amended his witness list. Tuesday, the day the trial was supposed to occur, Mr. Simpson did appear. A sheriff's department investigator interviewed him, and following that, the respondent dismissed the charges against Mr. Smith.
That was what date?
That was March 31st, 2009.
Was the fact that Mr. Simpson claimed the drugs were his known to defense counsel by a means other than what he learned 4 days before trial?
Absolutely.
And how did defense counsel learn of them?
The defense counsel was also representing Mr. Smith in the revocation proceeding. And I believe that he learned about it through that proceeding because that was Mr. Smith's primary defense.
Okay, so how long before trial was the revocation proceeding?
The revocation hearing took place on October 15th, 2008. The ALJ, I believe, found Mr. Smith, found for Mr. Smith. The state appealed, and then there was appeal, and it was upheld in November 13th of 2008.
And the proposed date of trial, the date when he learned about the conversation between Simpson and the district attorney, was what date?
March 31st, 2009.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Should the district attorney have disclosed this information?
The information that there was this confession in the revocation proceeding?
Should the district attorney talk with Mr. Simpson?
Yes.
Did he have a responsibility to contact the defense attorney?
I would say that it's the responsibility of the district attorney's office as a whole, not necessarily the district attorney himself, much like if a police officer produces a new report in an ongoing criminal case, you would expect that whoever's handling that case for the district attorney's office would disclose that to the other side.
But, I mean, the information was given by Mr. Simpson directly to the district attorney.
Sure.
But you're not going after the district attorney, are you?
No, we are not.
I mean, who would have known better about the information than the district attorney?
I'm not certain. I can't read into the...
Is that sort of prosecutorial discretion on your part?
I believe so. I mean, we're a reactive agency. We react to grievances filed by people.
When did she find out about the meeting with the DA?
The same day.
So somebody told her?
Yes, the district attorney himself told her.
So the DA told the attorney in charge that this meeting had taken place and that this was the information that he got?
Correct.
Then she went to the sheriff.
Yes.
And said, check him out, because he may just be, I assume the concept is, he may just trying to protect the other guy and is giving false information. And then we're going to dismiss this and then find out, no, he didn't do it either, and we got no one on the hook. Isn't that the whole point of this? As best we can figure out?
That's certainly possible. I mean,
all right. So she gets that information on the same day as the DA. So the DA told the prosecuting assistant attorney, right?
Correct.
All right. Delegated to her any duties. Maybe he couldn't delegate these. So then she gets to the sheriff. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, she did send a memo to the sheriff asking them to investigate.
All right. Then what'd she do?
After that, it appears the sheriff could not locate Mr. Simpson, and after that, I don't believe it's in the record what the respondent did with that information before the defense counsel requested it in late March of 2009.
Well, what's the harm here? Suppose that she should have revealed this information earlier, whether under Brady or under the ethics or just good practice, right? So ultimately, Mr. Lukoff's client gets off. Isn't that the goal here?
What's Mr. Lukoff's goal?
Yes, of course. It's his goal, and he's the one that's entitled to exculpatory material in order to do his job as defense counsel, right? So what's the big deal?
Well,
he found out, he used the information, the prosecution ended. Was there any harm to his client in the interim? I mean, was his client sitting in jail because of this? Was his client in prison? Was his client, what was the, maybe, or maybe harm isn't the issue.
Well, I guess I would first say that harm, I don't think, is a requirement to find a violation of these rules.
Okay.
And I'll get to that in a second. But generally speaking, the defense knows best how to use this exculpatory information. It's not in the record what Mr. Smith's status was, whether he was in jail or whether he was out on bail.
The other side says harm is an issue. They don't use the word harm, or they don't use the word prejudice, as I understand the case. They use the word material. It's material if it would change the result. I mean, I'm shorthanding it, but that's essentially it. So I just translate that into harm. So how do you answer their whole argument on material?
Well, that is in context of Rule 3.8. And if you look at the plain language of the rule, there is no requirement of materiality. There is no harm requirement. And even still, I don't think that there is I think that there's a very strong case that there was harm here. Let's say, best case scenario, Mr. Smith's out on bail. There are still conditions attached to that. And besides, you can't sort of undo, you can't cure this ethical violation simply by turning stuff over later. The ethical violation occurred in a several-month period where the respondent had not turned this information over. I only have one more sentence. I mean, what ultimately happened in this case was the prosecutor dismissed the case. They met with Mr. Simpson. It's entirely feasible that had we known or had the defense known that this meeting had taken place, they might have tried to get a hold of Simpson earlier. They would have named the district attorney and moved for a special prosecutor earlier in the case. It could have been resolved sooner.
To whose benefit would it have been resolved earlier?
I think to everyone's benefit. It certainly doesn't help anyone to have Mr. Smith either.
So you're saying the harm to Mr. Smith is the fact that it went on for an extra period of time.
That's part of the harm, yes.
Mr. Hendricks, there's some question apparently about a note that allegedly was given by the district attorney to the assistant district attorney. What's the significance of the note, if anything?
I would say that the significance of the note is only in that it contains the information that Simpson had met with the district attorney and confessed with him, thereby making the district attorney a potential witness. The note itself, the physical note, is not what OLR is mainly concerned with. It's the information reflected in the note.
Is there a dispute as to when that note was found by the assistant district attorney?
The district attorney has stated that he gave the respondent that note the day of the meeting with Mr. Simpson in early November 2008. The respondent has stated that she does not remember when she received it. So there's no real dispute. It was given to her in early November. And I think that's corroborated by the fact she asked the sheriff's department.
I cannot think of any ethical provision that has harm as a part of the analysis as to whether a violation occurred. I think of harm as part of the analysis, the nature and extent of the harm, as to what sanction, if any, should be imposed. But I make that comment without looking at all of the code provisions. So my question to you is there any code provision that you are aware of that has harm as part of the analysis of violation, has harm as part of an element of a violation?
I can't name any right now. I'm not saying that they don't exist, but I think that your idea, your conclusion that harm, at least in this situation, this rule, is mainly goes towards sanction and the appropriate sanction in this case. I mean,
do you think that a defense lawyer would be charged with similar violations for not providing 30 days notice of an alibi defense?
Well, we're talking about two rules here. I mean, the rule 3.8F1 is the prosecutor's duty, so it could not be charged to a defense counsel.
Okay, but, you know, if it's violating a statutory duty, there's that notice filed by statute. To be perfectly honest, it's been my experience that that is regularly not complied with, but it is an obligation. I mean, have you ever thought about that? Is that something that would be open to possible prosecution now if this case goes forward?
I have not considered whether or not that specific scenario would occur, but I would say that, you know, the rule 8.4F, which involves these discovery statutes, that's already there. It already can be applied to other discovery disputes, or even if a defense attorney did not turn over information or something else that was requested. I think that that would be a possible scenario.
Do you have any concern that the Supreme Court ethical rules are being used as a litigation tool?
In the context of this case, the underlying criminal case has been concluded for some time.
Well, not just in the context of this case. I mean, if we agree with you and the assistant district attorney is disciplined for this, you think that'll have any effect in the future on conduct between district attorneys and defense counsel?
Well, in the future, I would hope it shouldn't, because this rule already exists, and OLR's interpretation, I think, is very, you know, it revolves around the actual language.
We have a statute made by the legislature that controls what has to be provided along with case law that amplifies it. But this is a different tact, to use the Supreme Court rules, not just an argument that a statute was not complied with. And, you know, there's a very different way of hitting a lawyer, telling the lawyer you're an unethical person, than you read the rule wrong, the statute wrong. So it's a very different way of coming at an attorney with the ethical rules rather than relying on the statutes that in the past have controlled the obligations of prosecutors in criminal prosecution.
I guess I just have two brief things to note. I think the ethical duty is independent from the duties that prison, you know, that prosecutors have. Mm-hmm. For example, in civil cases, OLR generally does not, it holds off until the civil case is done. And I think, you know, in terms of an ongoing criminal case, I believe OLR does the same thing, where we try not to muddy the waters or give one side an unfair advantage using the ethical rules. Not every grievance is going to result in discipline, and not every valid grievance is going to result in some sort of sanction. OLR has a discretion for diversions, for education, for private reprimand. So
I know that. I guess my concern is that to me this seems a different tack for defense counsel to take than at least what I've seen in the past. So, and if it's not to you, you have much more experience than I do on things that you see. We only see the things that come all the way up here. So.
Well, what about, I understand the issue. The issue is here, whether you can have a higher ethical standard for a Brady violation than the constitutional standard for Brady violation. And that if the failure to make revelation about the DA's meeting is not a Brady violation, it should not be an ethical violation, because we got that covered in the criminal law, and we shouldn't ask the prosecutor to do more than the prosecutor is required under the criminal law. Isn't that the essence of this case?
I think that is one of the main disputes, but I think it's not helpful to think about the ethical obligation as a Brady violation. The ethical rule is broader. It says.
Well, that's the issue. Whether the court's going to say it's broader.
I mean, it says all evidence or information.
Right.
You know, I think all means all. It doesn't say material evidence or information. It doesn't say that which is not cumulative. And there's two different systems between the prosecutor's ethical duties are different from their constitutional obligations.
Well, for example, there are other provisions that deal with the criminal law. For example, 20:3.8a. A prosecutor in a criminal case or proceeding that could result in the deprivation of liberty shall not prosecute a charge that the prosecutor knows is not supported by probable cause. Now, sometimes the prosecutor is perfectly reasonable and thinks that he is supported by probable cause and loses, right? Court says it's not. There may be times when the prosecutor is going to prosecute even though he knows it's not going to win because it's not supported, but has another motive in the prosecution. Whatever it is, it might be perfectly valid and a good public policy. It might not be. But he does more than lose the case if he prosecutes without probable cause, knowingly prosecutes. That's an ethical violation.
Right. And I think it might be helpful to think about something like ineffective assistance of counsel, where that's a situation where an attorney can have a criminal case overturned or looked at again, but yet is not an ethical violation necessarily. They're two distinct.
What's the ethical violation there? Incompetence?
Yeah, it could be, but it's not necessarily. They're not identical.
Mr. Hendricks, could you summarize for me briefly what the referee found here, concluded, and his or her recommendation?
Certainly. There was a large number of undisputed facts in the case. The referee found that the evidence or the information in this case was not material, and it was cumulative, and therefore did not violate 3.8F1, and similarly did not violate the discovery statutes that are enforceable through the ethical rules.
Was the recommendation here to dismiss?
Yes, the referee then recommended that the case be dismissed because it was on summary judgment. So, I guess briefly, I just want to say with 3.8, there are two elements that trigger disclosure, and this disclosure has to be a timely disclosure. It has to be all evidence or information known to the prosecutor that negates the guilt of the accused or mitigates the offense. Olar's position is that the rule is pretty clear. Even so, this information is material. It is not cumulative. And Olar asked this court to find for summary judgment in its favor, find the respondent violated the rules, and remand the case to the referee if the court finds that sanction is not able to be determined through the record, or asks for a public reprimand if the record is sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Jeffrey Mitzfeld, representing Sharon A.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Mitzfeld. My colleague, Marty Kohler, and I represent the respondent, Assistant District Attorney Sharon Rick. Sharon is here in court today. The reason we're here is because the Office of Lawyer Regulation wants to sanction Ms. Rick for following the law. OLR has levied two accusations against Ms. Rick. First, they've alleged that Ms. Rick failed to comply with her statutory discovery obligations. And second, that she failed to comply with her ethical obligations under Rule 3.8. Ms. Rick complied with her statutory discovery obligations. To prove a violation of her statutory obligations, OLR has to convince this court that she was, one, aware of material exculpatory evidence, two, that the material exculpatory evidence was in the exclusive possession of the state, and three, that she did not disclose that exculpatory information within a reasonable time before trial. For three reasons, Ms. Rick did not violate her legal discovery obligations. First, the information here was not material. It was cumulative.
Simpson, well, there's a difference between materiality and cumulative, isn't there? Well, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me. Cumulative, it can be material, it can be probative, but cumulative means, I don't know, cumulative. Adding on. Not necessary.
Why aren't you saying that this is not exclusively the state? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Why is that our position?
No. You had three points. One, she had to be aware. Two, the evidence was exclusively in the state's position. And three, it wasn't disclosed in a reasonable time. Was it exclusively in the state's position?
No. Simpson was readily available as a witness.
You had to know about Simpson. How did the defendant know about Simpson?
They were in the car together. Simpson provided a statement to Smith's probation agent. Attorney Lukoff testified at his deposition that he was aware of Simpson from the outset.
Okay.
Simpson was available for Attorney Lukoff's investigator in January.
All right. So was that enough to satisfy the state statute?
I think it is. I think because the information wasn't in the state's exclusive possession, no disclosure was required.
What about the meeting with the DA? What about the meeting with the DA?
Right. It's our position that Simpson was as aware of the meeting with the district attorney as the district attorney was.
Well, but I don't care that Simpson was aware. We're dealing with the prosecution of Smith.
Correct.
Lukoff was representing Smith.
Right.
So when was Lukoff advised of the meeting with the DA?
He was advised 4 days before trial.
And how many days after the prosecuting district attorney knew about the meeting with the DA?
I'm sorry, I don't...
When did Ms. Rick know about the meeting with the district attorney?
I think it's a fair inference that she knew on November 7th.
Okay. And when did she advise the defense counsel?
She advised defense counsel the day after defense counsel advised her of...
Which was?
March 27th, 2009.
That's about 4 months, give or take, right?
Correct.
Right. So what's your position on that? Did the DA... Did DA comply with the statute on that disclosure?
She did. The statute requires disclosure within a reasonable time before trial. Given that the information at issue is that Simpson exists and he is taking responsibility for the drugs, I don't think that information would have required more than 5 or 10 minutes for the defense to gather and incorporate at a trial.
Counsel, we're talking about a note that appeared in the file at some point that was unsigned.
Yes.
Was it on any kind of letterhead indicating that it had come from the district attorney?
No, it was on a sheet of loose leaf
paper. The referee in this matter, as his conclusion of law stated, the note was cumulative and immaterial, not cumulative or immaterial because it was cumulative, right? The referee found it was cumulative and immaterial.
Right, that's my understanding of the referee's decision.
What does the record say? The referee does not, to my reading, explicitly resolve the difference between the district attorney's affidavit, I suppose it was, that he indicated that he gave her the note on the day of their conversation versus your client's lack of recollection in regard to when she first came in possession to the note of the note, except that she knew that it was there at the time of this conversation when things are heating up and people are getting ready to actually go to trial, as opposed to a file sitting on some shelf for 5 months.
He did not resolve that, and he didn't need to resolve that.
Well, he implicitly, well, he I think in the conclusion of law, he implicitly says, even if she had it, it was immaterial and cumulative.
Right. Ms. Rick testified that she was made aware of the information in the note, presumably by talking to former District Attorney Niskus, the day that District Attorney Niskus says the conversation took place. She does not recall being handed the note, being given the note, but she was able to find it on.
And she recalls being told that information in early November, right?
Correct.
And then on or about November 7th, she contacts the Racine County Sheriff's Department and asks them to do further investigation, right?
Right.
So what happens, the Sheriff's Department, the record indicates the Sheriff's Department makes numerous attempts to contact Simpson but is unsuccessful. Does the record indicate that the Sheriff's Department got back to your client and in any kind of written form or otherwise and said we've tried and tried and we're not able to get a hold of this person?
I don't know the specific answer to that question.
If
I believe
it's not in the record, then don't. Yeah.
I'm not aware of the answer to that question.
There was a revocation hearing for Mr. Smith?
There was.
Did the district attorney's office play any role in that hearing?
No. OLR has also accused Ms. Rick of violating Rule 3.8. By its plain language, the rule requires timely disclosure of evidence or information that tends to negate the guilt of the accused. Ms. Rick complied with Rule 3.8 because her disclosure was timely. Timeliness in the context of Rule 3.8 has never been considered by this court. It is not defined anywhere in the Supreme Court rules. And I think it's eminently reasonable to think that a disclosure is timely under the ethical rule if it is timely under the statutory interpretations.
Is it your position that we should interpret the ethical rule in the same manner as the statutory constitutional provision is interpreted?
Yes, it's okay.
Period.
Yes, we believe there should be a materiality and an exclusive possession component.
Okay. What does material mean?
Boiled down, it means would it have made a difference at trial? I know there are a number of different formulas for whether something is material, but
I don't know if it means at trial, but I think that it means would it have been different? Might have been, years before trial.
I think for Brady purposes, materiality is typically considered by looking at all the evidence in a case in a trial, which didn't occur here, and determining whether if a jury had heard the evidence that was not disclosed, whether jurists would find that that information would have made a difference if the defendant would have been acquitted instead of being convicted. I would like to point out that although Rule 3.8 could have required immediate disclosure, as OLR argues for, it does not. It simply requires timely disclosure.
Let's take a look at the timely disclosure then. As I understand it, in paragraph 28 of the referee's report and recommendations, it indicates that according to a sworn affidavit, Niskey, the DA, then verbally told Reek about the meeting and gave her the Simpson note later that morning? Is that the date of November 7th we're talking about?
We don't know the date of that conversation and the date that District Attorney Niskus turned the note over.
I note that paragraph 25 of the referee's report says on an undetermined date in early November 2008. But I heard you respond, I thought, to the chief's question about when did Attorney Reek know as on November 7th.
Right. We're able to pinpoint November 7th because on that date there is a request from her to the Racine County Sheriff's Department to investigate the situation.
Are you in any way contesting paragraph 28 of the referee's report? According to a sworn affidavit, Neske then, I take this to be on the same day that he received it, told Reek about the meeting and gave her the Simpson note later that morning. Help me with that.
That paragraph is a stipulated fact between us and the Office of Lawyer Regulation. We believe the clause, based on Attorney Niskus's affidavit, clarifies that that's based on his word. Ms. Rick has testified under deposition that she does not recall receiving the note on.
Yes. And that note was, according to his affidavit, and according to paragraph 28, was Attorney Reek was told about it the day of the meeting, and then later that morning, the district attorney gave her the Simpson note. Do I have that right, or do I have that not? It's page 106 of the blue brief. Let me read it verbatim.
Why don't you get the, it's the findings of fact of the referee.
We're looking at page 106 of the appendix, paragraph 28.
Yes, that's right, counsel. But I'm just trying to understand, is it the very day of the meeting that the district attorney had with Simpson, that he informed Reek of the meeting, and then later in the morning gave her the Simpson note?
Even if we assume that the conversation between District Attorney Niskus and Ms. Rick occurred the same day that Niskus received the information from Simpson, it doesn't make a difference because a disclosure to be timely has to be done within a reasonable period of time before trial.
I know, I'm just trying to get the facts. That's an old TV show. And I guess maybe the best I hear you saying is the meeting took place with the DA and Simpson in early November. And we know that on November 7th, Reek sent a memo to the Sheriff's Department.
Right. We don't know the exact date that Simpson came in and talked to DA Niskus. The note itself is unsigned, undated. It's on loose leaf.
Okay. So timeliness. Let's take a look at 3.8. 20.3.8 is denominated special responsibilities of a prosecutor. And we're focusing, of course, on F1. And it says a prosecutor in a criminal case or proceeding that could result in deprivation of liberty shall make timely disclosure to the defense of all evidence or information known to the prosecutor that tends to negate the guilt of the accused or mitigate the offense.
Now, your definition of timely is what?
That a disclosure is timely under the model rule, Rule 3.8, if it is made in time for the defense to make effective use of the information. That's what Wisconsin law requires.
Well, our model rule, we didn't adopt the model rule when we did 3.8, did we? The ABA, when you talk about model rule, I think of the ABA model rule.
I can look. I believe it is either identical or substantially similar.
It might be substantially similar. I'm just looking at the comment that starts, the Wisconsin Supreme Court rule differs from the model rule in several respects, and then ends up saying care should be used in consulting the ABA comments. So that's, but I say that just generally. So you can respond to me. It may be different, but not for purposes of here today that we're talking about.
So. I'm looking at the 2008 edition of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, and Rule 3.8 says a prosecutor in a criminal case shall make timely disclosure to the defense of all evidence or information known to the prosecutor that tends to negate the guilt of the accused. So, by my reading it, they are mm-hmm. identical.
With regard to that sentence.
Correct. Mm-hmm. When we look at subsection G1 of 20:3.8, that says that a prosecutor is required to promptly disclose evidence that calls a conviction into doubt. To me, that suggests that Rule 3.8 could have said prompt disclosure, could have required prompt disclosure, but instead says timely. And I, as I said before, I think it's eminently reasonable to think that a disclosure is timely when it is made in time for the defense to make effective use of the information. And certainly, given that we're here looking at a rule that's never been interpreted by this court and doesn't provide any clarity as to what a timely disclosure is, I think it was more than reasonable for Ms. Rick to think that a timely disclosure under her ethical obligation would be a disclosure that was required by law.
Do you think the meeting with the DA was of a different kind of information than the prior information that Mr. Lukoff had?
No, I think it's one more person that Simpson confessed to. I don't think former District Attorney Niskus has any special credibility. I don't think he should be held out to any sort of gold standard. A jury would be asked to consider his credibility just like any other witnesses. So, no, I think it's just one more person to whom Simpson confessed.
Well, apparently may have induced dismissal of the prosecution. That's which they didn't get before the time.
Even if Simpson came to court and testified and told the jury the drugs under the car that were found in the car were mine, Mr. Smith had no idea about those drugs, I still think a reasonable jury could and would find Smith guilty. He was observed by officers reaching under his seat. Lo and behold, that's where two bags of marijuana are found. I think that's more than enough to find him guilty of possession of marijuana, even with Simpson's confessions. And the only way that District Attorney Niskus or the probation agent could have testified is if Simpson were to either not show up at trial or if he denied possessing the drugs at trial. And so then at that stage, in theory, the defense could have, had there been a trial, bring out a parade of witnesses to whom Simpson had confessed. That goes to the materiality, it goes to the harm.
And if that had happened, of course, the state would have had the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Simpson to provide additional testimony in regard to possible motivations for falsification. It's not unheard of for co-actors to claim responsibility for the things that they ought not to have, the contraband that's found in a common location, such as an automobile, and the state would have had every opportunity to explore it if that had happened, right?
Right. As we explained in our brief below to referee Dubas, the claim that Simpson possessed this marijuana is dubious at best. Smith had a number of felony convictions, was a bit of an older gentleman, whereas Mr. Simpson, no criminal record, a younger man. I think it's entirely reasonable to infer that Mr. Simpson may have been influenced by Smith or provided some sort of incentive to claim responsibility for the drugs at issue.
So rather than act on information which might or might not have been true, your client referred the matter to the Sheriff's Department for further investigation in light of the new information, right?
She did.
And she did so within a week of learning about it, correct? Possibly sooner, but we don't know because the first date is pinned down as early November.
Right. We don't know exactly how long afterwards.
Well, we know it was within a week. If something happens in early November and then another thing happens on the 7th, that's a week.
Right. We're not claiming that it's the prosecutor's obligation or right to determine the reliability of information. I think it's entirely reasonable to send this information out, but ultimately we're here to determine whether Ms. Rick violated her professional responsibilities and whether she violated her statutory responsibilities. And she disclosed the note. The system worked. There was no harm here. And the defense had more than enough time to introduce this information had there been a trial. I wanted to...
What do you think about my paradigm of analysis? Let me tell you what that is in my mind's eye. It's this. That harm is not an element of the violation. That harm may come into play when you're considering the nature and extent of sanction, but not whether or not a violation occurred. I asked your opposing counsel if he knew of any provision in the code that had harm as an element, and he wasn't able to respond to that. Do you know of any code provision that has harm as an element? That's question number one. And question number two, do you think harm belongs in the analysis of whether or not there's been a violation or in the analysis of sanction, if any? Do you want me to repeat those?
No, I understand your question. The only hypothetical I can think of where harm would go to an element would be an attorney disclosing otherwise confidential information if he or she believes that the client is going to engage in a crime or fraud. So I would think the attorney would have to look at harm to the public or a specific person. I'm not aware of any element or any ethical obligation that requires harm as an element. That's my guess.
Well, is there any evidence in the record? I'm going to ask your opposing counsel this when he gets up for rebuttal. Is there anything in the record to indicate that the withholding of the note was intentional or part of a purposeful scheme?
No, there is no allegation of that sort.
Does the record indicate and this is sort of a side inquiry, but I think one that is germane to the discussion we're having. Does the record indicate approximately how many files your client was responsible for handling at the time, at the relevant time?
She testified at her deposition that she handles approximately 200 plus cases a year, and that at any given time, she handles between 75 and 100 cases. That's my recollection of her testimony. Justice Bradley, going back to the second part of your question, I would agree that the harm is a question for determining a sanction. We believe that Ms. Rick complied with her legal and ethical duties, and that there is no reason to sanction her because she complied with the rule, she complied with the law. I explained in my briefs that there was no harm here. Smith was kept in custody by his probation agent, who likewise did not believe Simpson's story, and that he was out on a signature bond while this case was pending. And in any event, he could have been not only prosecuted but convicted of the offense for which he was charged.
Was there any obligation to advise defense counsel when assistant district attorney sought the sheriff's help? You're saying no, that she had no obligation under Brady or?
She had no obligation under Brady or the ethical rule. The ethical rule only requires timely disclosure.
So if this trial was a year later because of congestion in the court or whatever, she would have no obligation to present it except 5 days before trial?
Well, I don't know if 5 days is the...
10 days.
I mean, the rule just says
30 days.
I don't know. The rule requires timely disclosure. The information here wasn't, it was not a murder weapon that was found or some exculpatory DNA evidence that would require retaining an expert to analyze. It was simply that Simpson had also confessed to one other person in addition to the people we know about.
Counsel, does this court owe any deference to the referee here? Is this, should we evaluate the referee's decision as clearly erroneous or on that standard, or is this purely a question of law that we're looking at today?
Well, the findings of fact were agreed to, and so we would agree that this court would be conducting essentially de novo review.
In terms of interpreting the statute and then applying these facts to the interpretation, is that what you mean by de novo review?
Right. I wanted to briefly touch on, a concern that I have about this entire process. When you pull up Ms. Rick's name on Google, the first thing that pops up is pending disciplinary matter.
Where? In the regular Google, not in the state bar.
Just on a Google search. I see my time is up. I would like
make your comment, counsel.
OLR is seeking a public sanction of Ms. Rick, but I think the damage has been done. I think it calls into question the way that this matter has proceeded. An attorney's reputation is critical to a successful practice, and her name has been dragged through the mud already. We would ask this court to affirm the referee and dismiss this matter. Thank you.
Do you have a suggestion about OLR procedures to both protect the public and the attorney?
Colorado has a method whereby an attorney throughout the disciplinary proceedings is kept anonymous. The case that I cited was In Re Attorney C. I have no idea who Attorney C is. And only if and only if there's a proven violation of an ethical rule and a basis to publicly sanction someone, does his or her name then become published. So I think that's a suggestion.
That's an interesting one, because much of our OLR procedure was, if my memory is correct, based on Colorado. And as you know, our disciplinary proceedings don't become public until it goes through the OLR, then a preliminary review committee on probable cause, and then there's a filing of complaint, and then it's open. But that doesn't mean that's the only way of doing things. There are many states, there are several states that have it open immediately as soon as the grievance is filed.
Well, my answer to that would be that, in essence, then OLR is acting not only as the prosecutor but also as the judge, because by going through that process and filing the complaint, the matter becomes public and the damage is done at that point.
Well, that's true in any criminal proceeding. This is not a criminal proceeding, but it's true in any criminal proceeding until when that complaint is filed, it's public. And if the person is ultimately acquitted, it's still public.
That's another poem I have.
If it's dismissed, it's still public. Right?
And the court. I have an issue with that as well. But.
Right. Okay.
Another day.
Different day.
Right.
We won't deal with that today. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hendricks?
I will anticipate Justice Gailman's question about the respondent's intent. I just want to say briefly, the rule doesn't require intent. OLR doesn't have to prove it. The only evidence I have, or that I've seen in the record regarding intent, is that she did offer inconsistent dates as to when she received the note or when she had seen it. Other than that, I'm not aware of anything one way or the other.
What was the inconsistency?
When she first gave a copy of the note to the defense counsel, she said, based on this note, I contacted the sheriff's office.
She said, as I told you yesterday,
and then,
when I received this note, I referred it to the sheriff's department for investigation. Yes.
Back in November. In her correspondence with OLR, she said that she had not seen the note before the day she had turned it over. And that's in the stipulated facts in the referee's report.
Based on one, you're fine. Okay, you've answered that question. Now, Mr. Misfeld has conceded it quite properly that eventually the note would be turned over as exculpatory. But my question to you is, does a prosecutor, in your view, have the duty to turn the note over immediately? Because I don't know if you've ever worked in a prosecutor's office. I don't know, and it doesn't matter. But my point is, prosecutors' offices, just like public defenders' offices, receive all sorts of information. A lot of people stop by the office and they want to talk. And they say some things that sometimes are not necessarily grounded in reality, to put it quite gently. And I wonder, in your estimation, if that is somehow reduced to writing, say it wasn't the district attorney, which adds an extra patina of authority to it, regardless of whose view of credibility is, you know, his credibility would be judged the same as any other witness if it went to trial, but it certainly adds an element of authority to it. Say it was one of the secretarial staff. So-and-so stopped by, said that defendant Smith didn't commit the murder, that he did. Does the prosecutor who receives that note have the immediate duty to turn that over to defense counsel, or is it more proper to for the prosecutor in an ongoing investigation to turn it over to the sheriff's department?
I provided a copy of an ABA formal opinion. As you discussed with the respondent, this particular section of the rule is identical to an ABA model rule. It's OLR's position that the ABA's opinion that information or evidence should be thrown over as soon as practically possible,
mm-hmm.
Is a good suggestion for this court in interpreting what, whether or not disclosure is timely. In this situation, I would say at least at the time that she contacted, the respondent contacted the sheriff's department, it's feasible to conclude she could have easily at the same time given that same information to the defense counsel.
What does the discovery and inspection statute call for a district attorney to do as far as timing?
Under 971.20.23, the district attorney has to do various things within a reasonable time before trial. And that includes disclose exculpatory evidence.
I don't disagree at all. Within a reasonable time before trial,
right,
is the standard, right?
Correct.
And then just as a follow-up, you know, that same section in sub 8 talks, for example, and, you know, previous to that is what a defendant has to disclose to the DA. I know it wouldn't be under the prosecutor section, but the 8.4F violation of a statute section, I just want judges to be on notice. You know, when someone doesn't provide an alibi defense, is a judge supposed to turn in that lawyer as being potentially unethical? You know, judges have a duty. If a lawyer is unethical, and you're saying a violation of a statute is unethical, it happens pretty regularly when people blow discovery deadlines or they seek some sort of relief or, you know, they don't exactly comply with a statute. Alibi defenses is the easiest one that comes to mind. I mean, oftentimes you find that out almost at trial. But it's supposed to be 30 days, so that's a violation. So
I think that obviously judges do have a duty to disclose, but again...
No, a duty to report.
A duty to report. I'm
right.
Sorry, duty to report, correct. But not, you know, OLR does not go after people who don't fail to report things. We are a grievance-based agency. You know, we act on the information that people give us.
So what's the answer? Is a violation of the statute an ethical violation?
Yes.
Okay.
I see my time is up. I just wanted to...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you as well.
Start to practice law. Please come up. That are in the clear cut, and have to make a decision and go with it. And then bear the consequences. This is not the first case our court has had relating to disclosure in criminal cases, and they are very, very difficult. Difficult for counsel practice, difficult for the OLR in making its discretionary decisions to prosecute, and difficult for the court. We appreciate both your arguments today and your candor with the court. That concludes the argument in 11 AP 1049-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Sharon Rick. Court is adjourned for oral arguments in the month of February. The court will meet in the closed conference at 3:15. We are adjourned. The students will...